myself. It took me a long time to get here.
Both parents have spoken with each other, and they regret what happened. They've had a frank discussion with each other, and they're both of them are keen to now focus on getting back their county jerseys.
That these fellas will get such a f***ing shell shock next Saturday evening that we'll put them back in their f***ing asses for f***ing 10 years.
Okay, so lads, so the inter-county schedule has been leaked. Colm Keyes had this in The Independent, and he seems to think that the GACCCC has plans to start the season, obviously, on October the 17th, as we know. But the first two weekends are going to be the two remaining league rounds of the National League. So that's going to happen at the end of October, which, again, takes a lot of pressure off the clubs to get straight into Championship. You know what I mean? It relaxes managers. They now have all of October to try and get their players 100% right for a Championship start in November. And I suppose it's probably the right thing to do. It just definitely squeezes up the inter-county season into November and the first 3 weeks of December. So, like, I mean, I don't know, Conan, like, if this was club football being announced that this was the plan, everyone would be up in arms. Intercounty are getting a very, very raw deal. They don't seem to be complaining at all. Now, having said that, in December, they'll probably use Croke Park for quarterfinals, semifinals, finals, and that at least the conditions in Croke Park will be good, the underground conditions. So, like, I mean, they are getting a raw deal. They're not complaining, and they're trying to squeeze their Championship and two rounds of the league into about 8 or 9 weeks in October, November and December.
County's getting their all deal again as usual. I think it's ideal, like, well, given the circumstance we're in, because when I saw, like, some of these counties that were scheduling their finals for their club finals for September 30th and whatever else, I was thinking, does the county championship, the inter-county championship, need to start on October 17th? The GA just said that's the earliest it will start, and, like, I was thinking, why not just push it to November, and this way, finishing up the league, it ties up any loose ends. Like, you think of teams like Armagh and Antrim, yeah, who have been quite vociferous, and, like, they've got a chance of getting promoted. It'll tie that up, and it'll give you some games to get into the Championship, like competitive games and more training time. So I think, again, given where we're at in the world, like, this is a good way of doing it.
Yeah, so it looks like they'll have the provincials in November and then a quarterfinal, semi-final and final. There's no room for anything else. That's in the football. Apparently that it's been leaked that the hurling will be given a second chance. So every hurling team is guaranteed two games, and every football team is guaranteed at least two games, but they're using one of the games as the two league games. Do you know, Connor? So, like, I mean, yeah, there's just too many teams in the football not to do a straight knockout. And we did talk about last week about it potentially going into next year and how messy that could potentially come. There's no doubt it's a lot cleaner just to finish it just before Christmas.
Yeah, I think so. I think the prospect of a season running into February was going to make it, you know, you just had to accept the impact that COVID was going to have on this year's championship. But, you know, getting into February, then you're having a massive impact on the following year's championship. So it does look a bit cleaner, and, like, kind of, you know, even the prospect, I think we were talking about it, of, you know, did you want to do qualifiers or did you want to get into a back door? And that looked like it was going to be too tricky for a football championship particularly. Whereas, you know, you have it now. You know, it's a system that hasn't been in place for a long time, but everyone can understand, because of the circumstances, that it has to be this way. I mean, like, just, it does, it absolutely makes sense then to give, you know, players some sort of warm-up to finish up the leagues. I suppose, just from a personal point of view, you'd nearly like the championship to be coming, you know, the GA, inter-county GA, to be coming back with a bang when it first comes back, as opposed to the first two league games. But in terms of finishing up the league and giving them preparation for the championship, it makes sense.
It definitely makes sense. Like, I mean, and we give out a lot about the different decisions made, but, like, the way they've given the clubs 11 weeks, they've given the county 8 or 9 weeks, the way they're structuring it off, I completely agree with the two league games. You can't fault what they've done here, lads. You just can't fault it. And, like, I mean, one huge plus for inter-county players is the All-Ireland champions have got a December 19th or 20th for football, the last weekend in December before Christmas. Imagine the piss-up they're going to have after winning the All-Ireland at Christmas time with no club football to actually have to go back into, and club manager annoying them.
Yeah. And they're not all training as well in the middle of December instead. Everybody's finished. Wouldn't it be a great excuse, though, if it did run into January to get rid of the O'Byrne Cup and the McKenna Cup and everything else?
Yeah, no, I'm good. Like, I mean, but listen, like we said, but to be positive about it, because it's a very, very good plan within the short space of time that they have left, and their hands are tied. I saw Liam Griffin talking about the Wexford situation. Now, we kind of made a bit of a joke out of this last week. Like, I mean, there is no doubt that it's not an ideal situation in Wexford. Liam Griffin said, I understand there's a limit on time, but how do you explain to a player that their season could effectively be over after a couple of matches in a few days? Now, the one big glaring issue. I have no problem with Wexford playing a straight knockout and having six rounds straight knockout. They're having three guaranteed group games, then a semi-final and a final. Now, they'll probably put in a quarter-final. So they've got six matches for the winners. Everybody always talks about the one match or two matches that teams have. Like, the big issue with Wexford is they start on the 2nd. Their second game then is midweek on the 5th. So teams will be out after 3 days. Now, that's not really fair. If they spread it out to week, and had 6 weeks, and then week, another 6 weeks with their footballers, you know, push it out into at the start of October, and then Davey and Paul Galvin will have all of October, you know, to potentially prepare their teams. So, like, I mean, there definitely is an issue with the way Wexford have done this. They've gone way too extreme on it. But they have come out. It was Colm Keyes had this as well, and they've said that that was a county board meeting, and it wasn't. It was a full county board meeting, and it wasn't their CCC, their competitions controls committee. So they're waiting to see the intercounty schedule finalised before they're going to finalise their dates, Connor. So again, this was leaked out of a county board meeting. It was a provisional look at it. There's no doubt they're trying to finish up the hurling early. But now I think when they see the two league games starting in October, I definitely think I've no problem with the structure of Wexford's championship. I think they have it squeezed too tight. Do you know? Yeah,
they could surely push out the dates now a little bit, as opposed to having... What would that be? Would that be like two games in 4 days?
In 3 days, the 2nd and the 5th.
3 days, yeah. So there's scope now, especially as you said, with the league... With the league games being played before championship, that they can push that out a little bit. I assume I didn't see about this fully. Like, I assume that Wexford will be running off league games as well. That like, while club players will be out in the championship, they'll still get a chance to play with league games with their clubs once the championship is over.
Ah, they will. That's the minimum. I think every county, people kind of forget that club players will have league games as the intercounty season's going on, and they'll have games. You know,
you want to be playing league games in November, though? I'm not that mad keen on that.
Well, the Intercounty have to play their bloody championship. Like, I mean, let's be honest, what you're whinging about. Sometimes I think the whole, oh, the clubs are getting a bad deal, it's overplayed. And I think it's fashionable now, and it's a bit populist to be going, the clubs, and losing your minds, right? So, like, I've seen most counties' plans, and they're all fair. They're all decent. You see, Wexford's is way too short. Waterford's is too short. Now, the things they have in common is they have an outside manager. And, you know, county boards need to be a little bit stronger on things like that. But again, these aren't finalised. So you're losing your mind about a lot of things when they're not definitely finalised. And another thing is, like, most counties are doing it right, Conan, and have given their club players a fair championship. It's the ones that are being massively highlighted, like, this is a disgrace, this is Croke Park's fault. And it's not Croke Park's fault, it's the Wexford or Waterford County Board's fault. Now, should they be answerable to Croke Park? Probably. You know, like, I mean, Alan Milton is on record for saying there's no one-size-fits-all approach, and the idea that Croke Park would police this and tell everyone they must do it a certain way is naive. I think that would be an insult to our county committees. They know the terrain best. If they're a dual county, if there's players playing in different grades across different codes, it's a very, very tricky situation. You couldn't possibly organise the amount of championships the GA organise at club level from Croke Park. I take his point that maybe organising all of the competitions from Croke Park might be a little bit difficult, centralising them, all the different, you know, nuances and, you know, different structures that the county boards have. But if you're telling me there can't be a fixtures officer in Croke Park that the CPA can go to and say, look, we've got a very extreme situation in Wexford and Waterford. You know, the minimum should be a game every week rather than games midweek. Go up to that officer in Croke Park. He'll determine whether that's fair enough. And he can, you know, tell the Wexford County Board, that's not good enough. We've given you 11 weeks. You're taking the piss. change that. Do you know, Conan? I think that that's workable rather than have Croke Park dictate them all. But they should definitely have someone that's keeping an eye on them.
Mm. And you know what the most important point is about this narrative around clubs being screwed over and stuff is the only solution that I've heard is get rid of the intercounty game and we'll just have clubs for the rest of the year. And it's like, that's not reasonable. Like, nobody wants that. It's not good for clubs. It's not good for, like, everybody wants to watch the intercounty championship and it benefits everybody and the county players who have been training all year. Like, they play for the county teams, they're all day, do you matter? So, like, the, like, that is not a solution, get rid of the intercounty game. And that's the only thing I've heard from people who have been shouting about the clubs.
That's the thing, Connor. You're, like, from Mayo. Like, Mayo supporters are fanatical about intercounty. Imagine Mayo supporters who are all club, most of them would be club members, being told, here, let's just focus on a club championships, you know, here, and let's forget about the intercounty. Is this the reality on the ground, or is this just a Twitter thing, you know, and a CPA thing and a Joe Brodie thing, which extreme cases are being highlighted, people lose their minds. Is this the reality on the ground? I don't think it is.
I'd agree with you, Willie. I don't think so either. The thing that's kind of skewered this for me is that, like, there might be a couple, like, club players from Wexford, for example, that were looking at the prospect of, you know, having two games in 4 days and then their championship is over. You can sympathise with that, right? Yeah. But you have that at one end of the scale. And then at the other end of the scale, as Conan said, you've people giving out and then, you know, making no alternatives whatsoever. And the situation that they're giving out doesn't compare to the plight of a Wexford club player who might be out of championship in 4 days. It's small beans compared to it. And that's the problem. What's getting lost in all this is that, like, you're in danger then of classing everything as, you know, that there are some genuine concerns, that there's some not genuine concerns. And the problem is the genuine concerns mightn't be listened to because they just get overwrought by all these other small little complaints that don't really matter. I don't hear it on the ground. What I'm hearing, like I've heard murmurs on the ground at the moment that, like, oh, sure. Like, say in Mayo, for example, that we have we won league game. And then we're running into championship pretty much, and it's going to be over by the end of September. And then people are giving out that, like, you know, saying that, like, oh, well, sure, nobody will care about the league, the rest of the league then, that's going to be run off once the championship is over. But that's purely down to the individual motivation of the player. If you've no interest, that's your prerogative. Like, that's not the fault of the county board for the scheduling of it, whatever. So that's the thing, is that, like, that's my main issue with that, is that the genuine concerns are being, they're being overlooked because there's so many people complaining about the small fry. And as Conan said, there's very little alternative being presented either.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, I mean, the Wexford, I know I'm repeating myself, but the Wexford Club Championships is a first round, and then you have another, you're guaranteed two games. Like, I mean, that's all intercounty players are ever guaranteed. You know what I mean? In a normal championship, that's within the time frame that you have, and you have to play off five or six rounds, and then you have a hurling. Like, everybody talks about the teams that go out in that first round, and that's fair enough. But the other half of teams has three games, you know, and then you have another half of them has four, five, six. Like, I mean, six rounds to finish your championship in a minimum, in a small space of time, is not the end of the world. But, like, I mean, that's, I don't know. I think these things can get lost a little bit. And this is not a normal year, Conan. And we keep having to say this. And if we're talking about situations next year and we're asking to shorten the intercounty season to, you know, the end of July and give the rest of the year to clubs, every county board then should be able to manage their club championship around, you know, give them more, guarantee them more championship games, because you've got 5 months, you know, you've got 5 months maybe until you get to the All-Ireland phase. But this is an exceptional year, and I'm just tired of it. I'm tired of the giving out. But then again, I suppose the giving out maybe will have Wexford, definitely, you'd imagine they'll change their minds. I think the GEA have helped that by putting the two league games in October. I can see Wexford will change that structure. So I don't know, have we anything more to add to that?
No, like, that's like, if every county was doing what Wexford were doing or what they proposed to do, then we would be given out. But our solution would be give them 11 weeks instead, which is just what happens is what the GAA have done. Yeah. And given the club, as you said, even the club's 11 weeks, they've given the county 9-10 weeks. I just don't see, like, there's no other solution being presented other than just give clubs 20-odd weeks to finish their championship. It's not reasonable.
So some of the clubs have been given an insight into the challenges that they're going to be facing. Greg Ballycallan, club chairman, Dave O'Neill, has been talking about. He says, we'll have to sanitise all our equipment, hurls, cones, balls, ladders, all of it, before and after. We'll have sanitising dispensers there on site when players arrive. We'll make sure once players arrive, they go straight out on the pitch. When training is over, kids will have to leave immediately and we'll have to sanitise it and get it ready for the next group. At the moment, we'll close off our facilities. Well, you don't have to do that. It's not like you want to do that. You have to. Then he says the only facility we'll have open is the toilets. That's the rule, which will be sanitised immediately after every group leaves. Jeez, I was just kind of thinking that when you read that and you think of sanitizing everything before. Okay, is that a little bit extreme, Colin? Is that even doable? I'm not too sure that it definitely is.
I mean, like what I said there, balls and herds, like everybody has their own herd. And
yeah, that's their responsibility, I would have thought. Yeah, now, slitters would be the club's responsibility. So unless they have like a big bucket that they're just going to throw all the slitters in or. But yeah, sure, that would destroy the slitters, no? Because they become all heavy and wet.
Yeah, but like the cones, like no, there's no players going to be touching the cones. The manager again, he'll look after his own cones. And what was the other ladders? Forget about the ladders. You'll be all right. Don't worry about that. We have played football in 3 months. Just get back into it.
Yeah, you're not climbing up ladders. You're kind of doing the little dance along them, there, aren't you? That kind of.
Don't suggest that one here. You'll have a manager all over.
Yeah, but then here's the thing. And then he says players will have parents at home who have underlying conditions. And I just hope that we can all be responsible enough as an association not to pressure those players into taking a risk. That's a big thing, that your star player is a little bit worried and there's pressure going on him to play. I don't think that'll be a big issue. Jesus, I think this is a little bit more serious than a normal year. And if somebody's nervous about playing, I think they'll be given a complete free pass, Connor. I'm not sure that would be an issue. Now, I don't know what... I just couldn't imagine any manager I've ever played under putting pressure on a any kind of age player who is worried about his parents and the whole, coronavirus.
Yeah, I've heard scenarios envisioned where, you have, if it's the best player at your club or something like that, and he has parents at home with an underlying condition, will there be pressure on him? But the best thing I've heard, the comforting thing or the good thing I've heard, that anybody who's talked about this has just said that there'll be absolutely no pressure on anybody. And I think everybody's going to buy into that from the get-go. And even I was looking at Tyrone's schedule there for what they, what they have for league games and stuff like that. And there was a very pointed note at the bottom of their statement saying that, of course, it should be, it should be hammered home that anybody who has any issue with playing whatsoever, there'd be no pressure on it. So it's just good to hear it from an official point of view, as opposed to it being something that people will just kind of understand. It's nearly written into law that, nobody... There can't be any pressure but anybody. But you just like to think that everybody is sensible enough to considering the circumstances and considering everything that everybody has gone through, that nobody be stupid enough or nobody would be devious enough to put pressure on somebody where they might not feel comfortable playing otherwise.
Yeah, the Tyrone one's interesting now that you mention it, Connor. They're going straight knockout. They're getting no bad press for going straight knockout because that's what they usually do. Now, I know the league in Tyrone is taken very seriously and that they would be seen as good competitive games, but their championship is straight knockout, or am I mistaken?
No, the championship is not a straight knockout, yeah. So it's from what I could see, it's one round of fixtures and then it's straight into a quarterfinals. It's really packed. It's a really packed schedule. The only thing I'll say about the Tyrone one is that the dates they've lined out at the moment has players playing league on Fridays and Sundays over consecutive weeks. I think there's 4 league ends in the first 10 days. So, maybe they're, as you said, the leagues are competitive. That's what the league split into 2, by the way. So, that's the same in Mayo. Every league is being split in. If it has maybe 12 teams, it's being split into 6 and 6. So, the action's going to come thick and fast. And the only thing I'll say about that is that, you talked to Barry Solon recently as well. Injuries are probably going to be inevitable. And then when you have players playing 2 games in 3 days for 2 weekends in a row, you can imagine that in Tyrone, there could be a lot of people with soft tissue injuries and hamstring injuries and groin injuries, whatever. But it's fairly clearly, you definitely couldn't have a complaint about the lack of games if you were in Tyrone. You might have an issue with the schedule.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the knockout. But like, I mean, like I said, it's getting no bad press at all. I don't see anybody giving out about it. Padraig McDonald is a Kilmacud Crokes coaching director, and he's been talking about the challenges they face. Now, waiting to hear this, like, I mean, when you actually start thinking about the practicalities of this, the challenge for us is that most of the age groups from under 14 downwards, you're talking about anything between 80 to 120 kids in each group, says McDonald. That's just the boys. You have the camogie and the ladies on top of that to fit in as well. So actually just giving them the physical space to operate safely and within the guidelines is very challenging. The work of the COVID supervisor, getting all the health questionnaires filled out, taking everyone's temperature, all that stuff. Are you doing that for each session? How many supervisors are we going to need per age group? Does each of those pods in the initial phase need their own supervisor? That's the kind of stuff we need to work out. And I'm glad that's Parik's problem and not mine, Conan. That's all I'm saying.
I was thinking about Ballyboden. Kilmacud are probably the same. Like the Ballyboden, that stat they've got more under 14s than Leitrim has. And they're trying to do it on their couple of pitches, like with these regulations where it has to be 10 people per session or per whatever it is. But yeah, like that's going to be really tough. I was thinking it's going to be handy though for the player who likes to fake injury anyway. It's going to be the handiest thing in the world for him though to skip a session by just saying he's got a high temperature and not actually having one, but it's just such an easy out for somebody who doesn't want to be bothered.
Well, definitely is. But geez, with the sheer numbers that they have, like, I mean, it's just, the practicalities of it are absolutely terrible. Like, 120 children, and you're looking for a form to be filled out for every single one of them, and you're looking for children to, you know, parents to be responsible for taking the children's temperatures, and what if they're not, and are they sent home? And geez, it's a terrible, messy situation. Potentially, there's no doubt about that. Colin McShane was talking to Tomás O'Shea. Tomás is doing a load of interviews for Benetti Menswear, and McShane has been talking about he dislocated his ankle, and you have a 1% chance of doing it. It's that rare a dislocation. But he's hoping to be back for the championship. It's been very, very lucky for him in that the season has all been pushed back. But the problem is with him, he was saying, is that he hasn't been able to get quality physio on it. So I presume he's been in a cast, Connor, and then the cast comes off. And then, you know, the pain of doing that friction and doing all that stuff. And probably has to do that on himself because he can't be close enough to anybody else to do it. So, you know, it being pushed back and everything is grand, but definitely for his recovery. And you'd actually worry if it has, because that scar tissue can cause a lot of problems, you know. And yeah, he hasn't been able to see a physio and get the ultrasound done on it and get all that scar tissue broken up. You know, he could have problems later in the year.
The thing you worry about, like not just the ankle itself, which is obviously so rare, like he said himself, you have 1% chance of doing it. Like, I'm not sure what the percentage chance of a recurring injury for that ankle would be. But the other thing with that is that, like, Colin McShane will be looking at coming back into it, like, play a bit with his club maybe, but coming back into a championship that's going to be really thick and fast. And it's not just the ankle, it's the compensatory injuries that come with it, you know. So he might have put so much work into his ankle that his calf might begin to suffer. And then, you know, that with people that have been out for a long time, and he doesn't have a chance to ease himself back into it. And that'll be the case for, like, I was even thinking when you mentioned Colin McShane as well, that the kind of long period off has benefited Mayo. Like, I'm thinking with the likes of Jason Doherty and Colin Boyle, who are coming back from long-term injuries, but they're coming back into a completely different environment where you're thinking you have, you know, it's going to be knockout. You know, there's no way of easing yourself back in. So as well as, like, you know, the amount of people who, you know, you look at the Bundesliga, there's been an increase in injuries from, because people weren't used to doing the normal sort of training. And then you have people that have been out for a long, long time that are coming back into this environment. So it's like, hopefully that the likes of Colin McShane and the likes of Jason Doherty and Colin Boyle that I mentioned are going to be okay. But there is that risk there.
Yeah, no, there definitely is. So the Sunday Game did a piece on Louth and Meath in 2010 last night, Conan, and like they did it with Peter Fitzpatrick and Joe Sheridan. And I don't know, like, I mean, it's very hard to do a piece on that. I tried Martin Sludden myself here on the show because they're obviously doing a lot of nostalgia, and Martin politely declined. He didn't want to get into it. It came across, you know, all right the way he was. He didn't just say no. He explained it or whatever, and I understood completely. But, like, I mean, you can't really do a piece on that anymore without his involvement, or else what is Joe Sheridan, you know, going to say new about it, or what's Peter Fitzpatrick going to say new about it? That's been done to death. So I was kind of half excited about it, and then when I kind of listened to it, I was a little bit kind of like, what was that all about?
Yeah, I've actually just sort of thinking about it last week and put up just a tweet about it and put it on Facebook. It's the picture of Joe Sheridan sort of diving over the line, dropping the ball and throwing the ball, I suppose. But I couldn't believe just how, like, the drama that it caused underneath and all the comments still 10 years on. Like, you know, it just got everybody's backs up again. Like, a lot of people just feeling, like, you know, so scarred by it, and rightly so. And, like, you know, many people laughing at them. And, like, it just brought it all back up again 10 years later. And it just seems like it's not going to be a resolution for it. And, like, maybe that's where Martin Sullivan's coming from. Because, like, when I'm watching it back, I'm watching the aftermath mostly. And just, you know, his actions and his decisions and, like, you know, just the way he handles it. And you're not going to get anything else from talking to him 10 years later, but that's the person you want to talk to. That's the only person who can answer some questions about it. But, look, it's gone. it's heartbreaking.
Peter Fitzpatrick at the time in the post-match interview called Martin Sludden Dick Turpin without a mask. It's a classic line. But, like, I mean, obviously not consulting with his umpires was a huge mistake. You know, like, but when you say this, like, Joanne Cantwell kept stressing that referees make mistakes. Now, this was a very, very bad mistake. There's no doubt about that. But the big mistake was made that this game wasn't replayed. Like, I mean, that there's no doubt about that, that if this game was replayed, that controversy is put to bed. Loud were the better team on that day. They deserved the replay. They were absolutely robbed. And I just cannot comprehend, with the replays we've seen down through the years, that this absolute no goal, which decided a Leinster final, how the hell was this not decided that the fairest thing to do, you know, for the integrity of the competition and for Loud's chances, how was that game not replayed? I can't actually remember, because I wasn't working in media at the time, and I just can't remember. I remember there had been talk about a replay, but I don't remember it being taken that seriously. It was almost like Joe Sheridan was saying last night, it was being left up to Mead. And Mead weren't, well, I think Mead actually should have, being the big traditional county that they are, they should have offered the replay. Like, they were like saying, well, we'll wait until we're told, you know, and then they were never actually told. So, like, I do think that Martin Sludden's mistake was a bad one, but I think that Mead and the GEA's mistake, having not offered and facilitated a replay, was equally as bad.
Do you know what's interesting? That was, Wally, and just when Conor mentioned the tweet there and the reaction. So this happened in 2010. So Twitter wasn't, like, I think Twitter was in existence at that stage, but only in its very early stages. And, like, I think if that happened, let's say this year, for example, I would say that the reaction and the kind of movement behind a replay for Loud and justice for Loud, whatever, would have got to such a pitch that, like, there would have been so much pressure on me that they probably might have thought that the only thing to do was to stage a replay, whereas you just didn't have that back then. Like, even thinking about recent things like Newbridge or Nowhere or something like that, they developed a life of their own through mostly social media exposure. And so, like, I think if something like that happened today, and the Mead probably would have been thinking that, like, the PR move for them, the right thing to do would have been to stage a replay, whereas they probably could have got away with ignoring it a bit more back then. Maybe that's too simplistic a view, but just when Conor mentioned there the kind of level of the reaction that it brings on now, even 10 years from now. So you can only imagine if it happened, you know, only imagine how Twitter or something like that would react if it happened today. And I think it probably would have, it could well have had a bigger influence.
Just before you come in, Conan, it wasn't without precedent. Only 2 years earlier in 1998, Offaly got a replay because the referee blew it up, a few minutes earlier, and they were down in the game. And they still got a replay for that. Their supporters came out and sat in the field. Now, Loud supporters came in and tried to beat the shit out of Martin Sludden. So maybe they should have just sat in the pitch or done something.
I actually would love you to get Martin Sutton on to ask him about giving the fan a yellow card. Sort of like writing someone down and get flashed a yellow card about the fans. And, like, obviously his head was just scrambling at that stage. But yeah, like, for me as well, like, you talk about the legacy and then being a traditional county, like, that's tarnished, that one. That's their last Leinster title. Like, so yeah, it would have been in their best interest as well to go out and win it. Like, you know, if they did win it,
exactly. That's the thing. And the chance, Mead were very strong favourites going into that. Now, Loud played great the first day, but generally the favourites will win the second day. So Mead should have offered that replay. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, and no, oh, they're scrambling. The only thing I see from Meath now is like it should have been a penalty. Like, ah, come on.
No, that's nonsense. That's nonsense. There's no doubt about that. All right, we'll leave it there, lads, because we're continuing with our series of coaching on the show. We did fielding with Kevin Feely and we did the art of trash talking with Eamon McGee. This week, we're going to talk about the art of man marking. And one of the best man markers in the modern game is Mark O'Shea, and he joins us on the line. How's it going, Mark?
Good, Willie. How are things? You well?
Not too bad. How is everything down south? Kerry have not only flattened the curve, there's no new cases in the last 2 or 3 weeks.
Yeah, it's good down here, Willie, that, you know, things are quiet. I suppose we're lucky in rural Ireland, it's quieter. So from that point of view, so thankfully there's been no cases, so hopefully that'll continue. And we look forward to getting back in the football field, because it's been a long time now, and it's about time that we get back to the field.
Yeah, it must be driving you mad. Like, I mean, where's the Gaeltacht training? Out on the beach kicking ball out around there, I suppose?
This is it, yeah. A lot of teams have taken to the beach. You know, the Gaeltacht included, because there's plenty of beaches back in West Kerry. But look, I suppose the things that you took for granted before, we won't be taking them for granted again. And that's certainly the case with football. We're watching old games there now on the Sunday game, where before you'd be right smack bang in the middle of the championship. Now at this stage, really looking forward to going up to Croke Park, and as I say, look, hopefully it'll be later in the year, but at least we have dates now that we're coming back, which is great anyway.
Yeah, which is great, exactly. So we have some positivity. Come here, we're talking about man marking, and I want to start off by asking you this question: is there any enjoyment in man marking someone?
I think there is. You know, I was thinking about this today. I only started off as a cornerback when I was 21 years of age. And then, I suppose, I've played for the rest of my career, cornerback or fullback, with my club and my county. Well, with my club, I was lucky because I suppose I was able to play in numerous positions, and that was good. And, you know, there was times where I was playing in the forwards, central forward and full forward even. But there's certain, like, you know, I think Gooch and these fellas did a lot of damage to players, because when young people were growing up, they always wanted to be a Gooch. Nobody wanted to be a defender. He was that good, and I think there is certainly, you know, it's a dying art in ways, because what you see now is you see kind of mass defending as opposed to one-on-one, you know, man marking, which I had to do, which Tom O'Sullivan had to do, which Mike McCarthy had to do. Back in the day, Seamus Moynihan as well, you know, and that was it. Like, you had to mark your man. There was no protection. There was no support. It was just one-on-one. And, you know, you learned quickly. I was very lucky when I started off, because I remember we had the West Kerry car. Paddy was in charge, and he said, the West Kerry car was full up, because you had Darrow Kinnaida, Aidan McCarroll, Tomás. And, you know, so it was full up, and he told me to hop in with Seamus Moynihan one night, and he said, be like a sponge and just learn everything you can from that man, because he has it down to a T. So I just watched Moynihan in training, just kept in what he did, the way he was able to man mark at the near hand in. You know, but I suppose as a man marker, you have to be careful how you defend, because, you know, if you look at, say, myself and Tom O'Sullivan now, who two completely different players, in the sense that Tom was lightning pace, whereas I probably just read the game, because I wouldn't have had the same pace as he had had. So I would have maybe stood maybe not a yard, less than a yard in front of my man, that if I had my hand out, I'd be able to touch him and he'd be behind me. Now, it's a dangerous one, because, you know, if there's a ball in over the top, how quickly can you get back to cover off? And so, you know, you have to be so focused at all times when you're playing that game. But that's the way I started off, Woody, because I suppose I wouldn't have had the strength. When I started off, I remember even the 2002 All-Ireland Final, I was only 11 stone. If you fast forward then 10 years, 2011 All-Ireland Final, I was 13 stone. It's 2 stone heavier. So right. I could actually defend a lot differently then, as opposed to when I started off. So, you know, I wouldn't be taking fellas on for strength when I started off, whereas when I was finishing my career, I could match fellas for strength. And so, like, that's why I kind of played the yard in front at the start. But as time went on, I was able to play side to side, you know, and But it's something that I did do, and I don't think forwards like it. I don't think forwards like when you kind of play them that half a yard in front, because you're taking away their runs. And yeah. I'd always ask the boys, I'd always ask the Gooches, and I'd always ask maybe James, I don't know who after, what as a forward, what thing don't you like a defender doing? And that was one thing that certainly they didn't like, was when you would play that half a yard in front. But it's something that definitely that helped me. If you were marking a taller player, then you know you'd have to then mind maybe if that ball did come in high, and you'd have to maybe get back side to side with them. You couldn't, it's particularly now, say if you're marking Donaghy like in training, and there was high diagonal balls coming in, you had to be really careful there, because if you were playing in front, as they say, a high ball in, and all of a sudden he has you, So it's a tricky one. I think, as a defender, you have to play it as you see it as well sometimes. You have to, it depends who you're marking. I remember when we used to have games, and I suppose with modern technology, particularly maybe 2010 onwards, we'd have the games of the teams that we'd be playing, be it whoever, in the next round, and you could actually zoom in on the actual player and the plays that they did. So I did a lot of that. I would have checked, I would have done a lot of homework before games in watching the opponent, what leg he kicked with. And one thing that I always took great stock in was if we were maybe playing Galway or something, I'd always check to see how the player played in the previous game. And if he played poorly, I was really on my guard, because I knew, particularly if you're playing intercounty, good players rarely play bad twice. Right. So you'd really be on your guard. But so I did a lot of homework. I watched a lot of videos, particularly the way forwards turned, if they took you on, if they were good over their head, all that type of thing. And I think, but certainly going back to the point, it is a dying art. And I think young fellas growing up, what they want to do, they want to be on the other side of the field, being maybe a Conor Callaghan or a David Clifford. There's very few people that want to man mark now. And it's sad, because I think there's a huge, it's a lovely skill, being able to get down, block a ball, dispossess a fella, come out with the ball then and turn a defending situation into an attack. So I think I love watching fellas who can still do that. Keith Higgins is a great example of it, even though he's probably coming to the end now. But, there are still examples out there, but it is a dying art in my opinion, Colm.
Yeah, I suppose, would you have got much coaching as regards your footwork? And you mentioned tackling with the near hand. So probably the worst ever situation for a cornerback to be in is your man has the ball, he's turned and faced you, and you're backing off. In that situation, you're kind of a sitting duck. Are you looking at his feet at that stage? Are you looking at the ball? Or, you're trying to dispossess the ball or wait for him to play it? And that's easier said than done, when this fella's pulling all kind of tricks out of the book. Are you grabbing his hand to try and put him off? What are you doing in that scenario?
Yeah, well, we always had a rule down here that, when your man... the best way to stop your man was just don't give him the ball and get the ball before him. Now, if that didn't work, as you say, and if he gets the ball and he is taking you on, and it started off maybe with John O'Keefe, Paddy would have been very vocal in it as well, and then we would have gone on and, Jack O'Connor, they all would have been vocal in it and getting a hand in. It's stuff we used to do in training, just one-on-ones, and we used to do it, and I used to love doing it. And again, it's just like you said, it's like just getting a hand in, just trying to put them off as much as you can and being an absolute nuisance, really. But I used to always wait for them to take their play. And when they took their play, I used to try and pounce them. And because that's when they were most vulnerable. There were certain forwards there. And, I think they were so underrated. I'm talking about the likes of Andy Moore. And he was a nightmare to play against. And I remember playing against him in Croke Park with 50 yards of space in front of us. I remember the 2011 semi-final stands out. And just you're a sitting duck because there's, as I say, 50 yards of space in front of you and you're trying to take this fella on and he's taking you on. And again, you're just training, wait for him to take that hop or that solo so that you can get the hand in.
It's very difficult. You see some backs and they're doing a whole load of slapping and slapping and slapping and they're wasting their time and energy because it's very unusual to dispossess a good forward, when in between plays. They usually have it held fairly tight. You're wasting your time slapping until they're actually going to start playing it, right?
You are. Yeah, I think, like, you know, sometimes you know that they're going to get the ball, and if you can be strong with your arms and kind of get a kind of a nudge in without giving away a free to kind of put them off a small bit, that kind of helps. And something that I used to always do was, you know, if the play was maybe a teamwork coming on attacking against us, maybe their midfielder had the ball, I'd always be pushing my opponent out, trying to keep him away from the danger, right. And I'd just giving him little nudges to push him away from the play, and sometimes it worked, but other times it didn't. But no, look, you'd really be on your guard then when you were marking a forward that had 2 feet. Like, that was one of the toughest things, because, you know, the likes of Stevie McDonald, Bernard Brogan, Alan Brogan, these fellas, even, you know, they were just really hard to mark, because you didn't know what side they were going to turn. Was it left or right? Because they were able to kick with the right, they were able to kick with the left. So it was always a huge challenge trying to take them on. And then, not only that then, but it's the challenge, if you're being beaten in the middle of the field, it's a huge challenge then.
Yeah. If you're being beaten in midfield, Mark, you're wasting your time standing out in front of your man, because they're getting the ball too high up the field. I suppose marking from the front works if the ball is down the other end of the field. You know what I mean? And they don't have an area to run out into.
Yeah, but like there was days there, particularly I suppose towards the end, where, you know, we'd be playing maybe Dublin or so, and you'd be in trouble in the middle of the park, and you could just, the dubs are coming at you, and, you know, there's no place to hide then, you know, because you obviously have to be very tight, because you know your man is going to get the ball. And in those situations, you know, you'd have, you had different types of forwards. Like, you'd I remember now, like, say, when I started off, you know, you'd the likes of James Masters from Cork, who was very good at, say, maybe taking the ball in the loop. Maybe might wait for somebody else to win it, and he'd be off the shoulder, and he was a sweet kicker. Declan Quill from Kerry, very similar player. And so you'd have to study the player that you were marking, who it was. If it was an Andy Moran or a Michael Meehan, you know that they were going to take you on. Yeah. If it was a Bernard Brogan, you knew that this guy was seriously potent and could kill you on the scoreboard. So it all depended on the player that you were marking, and in a way,
Mark, were the lads coming on the loop much harder to mark, because they can just, because usually when they're coming on the loop, they're coming on the loop at another player that distracts you a little bit, you know, and then they're gone around behind him.
Yeah, I actually, believe it or not, I found those players the easiest players to mark,
right?
Because you knew what they were going to do, so you were getting very physical with that type of a player then. Whereas, like, you know, if you were marking, one of the toughest I've marked had to be Andy Moran, because every time he got the ball, and the thing about Andy was, like, you know, when you're playing against a real honest forward, when, like, they make one run, the ball doesn't come, they make a second run, and next thing they're making 5 runs and the ball still hasn't come. Oh, Andy just kept going, he kept going, and, like, right up until the end you saw him, like, how effective he was, because he was just incredible at getting out in front of his man, because he'd be after 5 or 6 runs and he'd still be doing it. And it was always a real tough day when you're marking Andy Moore, because then when he got the ball, first thing he was doing was taking you on. And if he wasn't able to beat you that way, he'd either pass it, he could kick a point. But he invariably did the right thing with the ball. And I always found him really hard to mark. Because, you know, as I say, strong, take you on, and you know, as we spoke about already, trying to get your hand to the ball, you know, make a tackle, dispossess. Sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't, but that was the plan anyway, you know.
Right, okay, and he's physically very strong. You made the point about going from 11 stone to 13 stone. Some forwards like to kind of get that bit of contact, maybe even to trip you up or knock you away, you know, like, I mean, knowing the forwards, say Kevin McManaman is the most obvious one, but Andy Moran would be as well. They want you to mark them slowly. They'll take one step away from you and then go into you, and then they have the air, you know, they have That's you it. Pushed up.
Yeah, no, definitely. And you mentioned Kevin McManaman. No, I didn't mark him that much, but he was one of those players too, that's like, you know, and you're right, they kind of lean in and then they go at you. And, it's very hard. It's really hard. And the only way you can really work on that is by doing it in training, by having those one-on-ones. And as a coach now myself, it's something that I would do with the players, because you learn fairly fast who your good defenders, who can stop a man up and stop the momentum, and then get in your hand, then get in your... But certainly when I got stronger, maybe put on a bit of weight, I felt that when I was able to stop them up, I was that bit more stronger then, and I was able to get better tackles in. I mean, in 2002, for example, I was marking Gooch a lot in training. And then you go from marking someone like Gooch to marking Dermot Marsden in an All-Ireland final, and it's like chalk and cheese, two different players completely. So there's certain things that you look back in and you say, geez, you know, if I had different training, maybe if I was marking the likes of a Johnny Crowley or a Darrell Kinnaird, two similar players to maybe Dermot Marsden, maybe you'd have a better chance. But, and then the day of the final, 2002, I played poorly myself. And, but you learn from these things, and you try and improve. But strength was an area that I had to work on. So I suppose, Pat Flanagan put a huge emphasis on the gym when he came in 2004. And I worked hard in the gym and got to a kind of a level where I could take fellas on physically. And, it certainly helped me with my career, because everyone's different.
Did you notice, lads, when they lean into you and feel that bit of strength, that they might not try to take you on? Because I often go to try and take a fella on, and if I felt, Jesus, he kind of pushes you back a bit, you might go back and recycle it, because he's too strong. Like, I often see the Mayo defenders, that's maybe why they're good. You might see even someone like Mannion that might go into Harrison and go, geez, no, without a good bit of speed behind me from a standing start, I'm not going to try and attempt this, So, like, being a big, strong defender is a huge, head start against a much faster, weaker defender, for example.
It is, for sure. And, if you were a forward and you were taking the likes of Seamus Moynihan on, you would no way bring the ball into the tackle with him, because he was just so strong. So you had certainly different examples of players. My own brother Tomás would have been naturally strong, whereas I would have had to work on that side of it. And certainly then when you go on, and even when you had the ball yourself, Cullum, you felt stronger holding a player off with one hand. Like, you just felt a lot stronger. And I remember in those earlier days, if there was a strong fella taking you on, you weren't gonna try and match them for strength, but what you did do, I suppose the same rules applied. You still tried to get the hand in, you still tried to dispossess when they were soloing or hopping, get a hand in, or block a ball when they were about to kick, and the same rules applied. Although in years later, when you were stronger, it made you a better player, because you were able to I suppose do those things knowing that you were a lot stronger, knowing that if somebody took you on, that you'd match them,
Yeah, exactly. Listen, Mark, thanks very much for all that. That's great stuff. We'll talk to you again.
Cheers, Willie. Thanks a lot.
Let's chill the beans. There still is a lot of work to be done yet. Just give us a small bit of time. Just give us a small bit of time. Let's chill the beans. But I'll tell you, give us a year, and a bit. Just give us a small bit of time. Just give us a small bit of time. Let's chill the beans. Let's chill the beans. Beans. Let's chill the beans. Let's chill the beans. Beans. Let's chill the beans. There still is a lot of work to be done yet. Just give us a small bit of time. Just give us a small bit of time. Let's chill the beans. But I'll tell you, give us a year, and a bit. Just give us a small bit of time. Just give us a small bit of time. Let's chill the beans.
Okay, lads, so the newspaper is very disappointing, I thought, this Sunday. There's only one piece in the Sunday Independent, which is usually very strong for GAA, and it's Colm O'Rourke, and he's going over a lot of the kind of old stuff. The headline is, "Another fine mess, we'll see us having a drink and a haircut before we can play." And I think that argument, I completely agree with his argument, and June 29th is way too late and all those things. But I'm kind of moved on from talking about that now. That's not going to change now. There's no doubt. There's no doubt they made a huge mistake with that. But he's talking about a similar team. He's talking about the COVID supervisor, which we had a laugh about last week. And he uses the example of Kilmacud Crokes, which we've been talking about. He says, with 183 teams going through this rigmarole, each player has to have a form filled out for every night's training or game. And then the Greens better not get into government anytime soon or they'll shut down the GAA altogether. 183 teams would mean 3,500 players, which could all add up to 10,000 individual pieces of paper every week. And that's just one club. So, like, I mean, he is using an extreme version in Kilmacud Crokes, and he's having a bit of a laugh about that. But he does make the point, if somebody has not taken their temperature and filled it out in the form, will they be turned away? What happens if Junior jumps out of Mammy's car and hears off to join his friends and nobody knows the first thing about a questionnaire? Or what happens about the person who has not got a printer? And, like, they are valid. They're valid questions, you know. Like, I mean, it's not going to be easy, Conan, to police all this. Nobody wants the job of a COVID supervisor. I saw Portlaoise announced on Twitter for people to nominate themselves. And, like, I mean, I just can't bring myself to do it. I'm happy in my ambassadorial role, and I don't think that I need to be a supervisor in my career right now.
Yeah, who's going to come into your role then if you move over? It's just, it would be too complicated. So. When I read Colin Maroke, though, I was starting to feel a bit annoyed, and I thought, this must be how Willie feels when I'm talking to him and I'm going through all these doomsday scenarios and picking out every single thing that could go wrong. I thought he was being a bit mischievous, and I know it's going to be complicated, but one way around it, I would imagine, is, like, if you haven't taken a temperature, like, let everybody know this, you're not getting in, so don't come down. Or if you're ticking yes on any of the form, then you're not going to get in, so don't come down, sort of thing. And yeah, I imagine as well that, like, the printer is one thing that I thought of straight away, but then I just imagine that surely you'll be able to collect these forms somewhere. Somebody will print them out. This is what the COVID supervisor will do when you're doing the report, at least you print them out for everybody. And you're right.
I can't foresee this messy situation that Colin's talking about on the very first day of training. But when people realise you're not getting in without your temperature checked and you're not getting in without the questionnaire, you know, you're right, he is thinking of the doomsday scenario.
Yeah, so I'm sorry for all those years, Willie. They're probably done your head.
He says, Connor, then he finishes it up and he says, the only logical conclusion that I can come to in all of this is that the advisory group was so clever that they decided that by putting forward such unenforceable guidelines that they will be ignored very quickly. That will certainly happen. But as always, clubs will do the right thing by their members. Within the next few weeks, I will be that sentry at the gate and will be expected to check on young players and maybe adults as well. Some young boy or girl will arrive at the gate mad for action without a form. What do you think I'll do? So O'Rourke's just going to let them on in. I suppose I would let them on in too. Like, I mean, you're looking at when we're talking about young children now who are not in a very high risk, very high risk category, and you know, maybe Conor, you just put your hand to their head and say, go on, you whippersnapper.
The important thing, well, like, I think, is operating within the spirit of the guidelines. Like, nobody is going to think, it's a 15-page document, I think. And, you know, like, I don't think anybody is going to be able to operate it to 100%. It just takes, like, you're on about the role of the COVID supervisor there. I had in my head that, like, while obviously every club is going to have an appointed COVID officer, that there should hopefully be an awful lot of people within the club that can carry out the majority of the duties, that can help carry out the majority of the duties involved. And as well as that, like, you know, that people just, like, take on personal responsibility and don't be a dick about it. Like, you know, to try and do your best to have your temperature checked and to fill out whatever forms you have, and relieve the responsibility on the COVID officer or on the people that have to look after this as much as possible. Like, that a manager or a trainer of a team, for example, could lead it and just have to check in with the COVID officer and something like that. That, like, you might not be ticking absolutely every single box, but you're making the best effort to do it. And you'd like to think that the vast majority of GAA clubs will do that.
Yeah, actually, I mentioned there's only one piece in the Sunday Independent that I'm going to talk about. The other one is Dermot Crowe, and he's talking about statues. And the headline is Immortalizing the Immortal. And the subheadline is, there are surprisingly few statues remembering greats of the games. And, you know, it was a little bit too boring for me to talk about in the chat on the show. So I didn't really have much interest in reading that. Maybe it's because statues are in the news a lot by people pulling them down. Maybe kind of got him interested in how many statues there are commemorating GAA players. I don't really, I don't care to, I don't care to discuss that.
Because you haven't got your statue in Port Leash fully yet.
Yeah, well, that would definitely be pulled down by now. There's no doubt about that. In the Sunday Times, then, we have an interesting piece from Dennis Walsh. Dennis has been going a little bit left field the last few weeks, and he's talking to Ronan Brady, who's a former Roscommon footballer. Can't say I remember him too much. And the headline here is Taking the Wheel. The transformation from footballer to circus artist finally allowed Ronan Brady to fully express himself. So Ronan Brady ran away to the circus. I always kind of thought that was a little bit of a joke, you know, like you say, I think you say that as a child, you're going to run away to the circus or something. He's actually done it. So he's now in a, he's now a circus act. He said it starts off saying, in the build-up to Ronan Brady's breakthrough performance in Riot at the Dublin's Fringe Festival, one of the show's producers discovered by chance that the muscular artist moving in harmony with a giant aluminium wheel used to play Gaelic football for Roscommon. So his act is, he's, there's a picture of him here, he's just hanging out of a big, it's basically like the kind of thing you'd wriggle around your hips when you were a child. It's just a huge version of that, and it's aluminium. So he says Brady was still trying to figure out how to make it work for him and the wheel. He knew that he no longer wanted to be a teacher, and his feelings for football had run a spectrum from all in to fold. So he gave up his job as a teacher, he gave up Gaelic games, and he went to join the circus. It's an incredible story, really. Like, I mean, it's like he sees Gizzy Ling's story and goes, look, I'll see you're 20 and I'm going to raise you another 20, Connor.
Yeah, talking about not being defined as a Gaelic footballer.
Yeah, yeah.
It was a really, like, really good piece, like really different and interesting. But the whole time, yeah, I was reading it, thinking, why is Woolley bringing this up? What does he want to ask me or slag me about here? So, but actually, it reminded me of the time Carlos McWilliams, so he plays for Derry now, and played for Derry Miners at the time, but he missed an Ulster Championship match to go do an Irish dancing competition. I think it was an All Ireland competition, and Joe Brawley wrote a whole article dedicated to him, slagging him off for missing an Ulster Championship game because he'd be going to Irish dancing. That was crazy carry on from Brawley, but this guy was 17 as well, like, and obviously he was Irish dancing since he was 4 or whatever. And yeah, Brawley just dedicated a whole article about, it was basically around the idea of like a man would play the Ulster Championship sort of thing, but now we've got fullbacks in Derry who are dancing instead, and it's like, oh, that piece has not aged well at all. It wasn't good at the time, and it's even worse when you think about it now.
Right, okay. Do you remember him playing, Connor? You're our Connor correspondent.
No, I don't remember him playing, but like my brother alerted me to this, to his kind of story there a few weeks ago, because his he's a cousin of, my brother teaches in Boyle in Roscommon, and he's a cousin of the principal there. So I'd heard this story before Sunday, but it's just fascinating. Like there's a couple of really interesting tidbits in it about how his experience in, he was a cornerback for Roscommon, but how his experience with the circus and that sort of stuff has kind of made him think that he should have let it go a little more when he was playing football, because he said he used to be the traditional tight marking cornerback, and that all he'd think about before a game was stopping his man from playing, as opposed to playing himself. Now, you know, trying to play a bit himself and maybe get up the field. Now, he probably played in a different era, but just like he thinks it's ridiculous now about how worried he used to be about that, just purely containing his man compared to the pressure that he has to put himself under now. I think he tells a couple of stories about being put on the spot and told to do something, you know, that he's no experience of before, and that how he found that liberating. So no, it's a really fascinating story. And just to fair play to Dennis Welsh again, because like Niamh Fitzpatrick last week, he's been finding stories that are, they're completely removed from COVID-19. These stories could be in the paper, you know, any time of the year. You know, yeah, we've known a couple of times before about how, you know, we get fed up with people, GAA players being asked, whereas, you know, these are interesting regardless of the times we find them, ourselves in at the moment. And and yeah, just like, if anyone hasn't read it, I just encourage them to go back, because it's really fascinating.
All right, so now we get on to the Irish Mail on Sunday, and there's some heavier pieces in this paper. Yesterday we have a special report from Mark Gallagher, the GAA too bonded to their past. So the subheadline on this is Association must revisit the historical links to white supremacist and slavery advocate John Mitchell. So he's making the argument that you know, a club like Castlebar Mitchells should be renamed, or the Mitchells Park taken away. And there's other clubs as well. He says there are over 1,600 GAA clubs on this island, and at least 10 of them are named in honour of John Mitchell. So he lived in America before he moved to Ireland. He did a lot of work for the nationalist movement in Ireland, and I think that's why the GAA clubs are named, or that is why the GAA clubs are named after him. But he settled in the American South, and he started a newspaper, The Southern Citizen, to promote the value and virtue of slavery, both for Negroes and white men. In his writing, Michael called black people an infinitely inferior people, and stated that it wasn't a crime or wrong to hold slaves, buy slaves, or keep slaves. So obviously not a very nice person, and was a white supremacist. Paul Rouse later in the piece argues then that if you sit down and begin this process of whether certain clubs should be renamed, you have to be clear about what your purpose is in doing it. What is the purpose of the name of the club, and what message do you want to send out? Michael Cusack published anti-Semitic views. Do we go back and rename the Cusack stand, take down a statue in Croke Park, rename Cusack Park in Ennis and Mullingar because of that? Or do we accept that it was of its time? Part of me thinks it's of its time. And then the other part of me says, would Castlebar Mitchells look any different if it was just Castlebar? And if there's connections to a white supremacist, John Mitchell, I don't have a very strong opinion either way, lad. So it might be a little bit heavy for us to be discussing here. There's another piece. Michael Deignan's in the Irish Mail on Sunday, and he's talking about central level, the GAA were facing a loss of up to 57 million. He's talking about the finances. He says, that's why I strongly believe that there has to be government intervention. Whatever about scrambling financially this year, every county will be doing the same next year, unless there's some level of financial assistance. We've all submitted our accounts and projections to Croke Park. Even with the most positive projections in recent weeks, there's going to be a substantial loss. And like, it got me thinking about the GAA make a lot of money and they spend a lot of money. Wouldn't it be a lot more prudent if they had put some money away for a rainy day instead of the club in Laois that wanted an extension to their dressing room? I know that's, you know, a worthy grant, but the example I'm using is next year, for example, if the budget is so tight, it's going to affect games development, it's going to affect all knockdown effect. And I suppose they would, on the other hand, Conan, they would get serious criticism if they were putting money away. So it's not really easy for the GAA, is it?
Yeah, we would probably be the first to criticize them as well. But I do think about that stats, it always changes, but 70-odd% goes straight back into the games. And in hindsight now, it's like, oh, was that very wise? Like, could you not have just put 60% in and kept some on the side? And like this Michael Deignan piece is actually a perfect example of what we're talking about. Like, you know, how everybody, the county boards and the clubs, they all need the inter-county game and the gate receipts coming back. You know, we need this thing bouncing again. And he's really painting a very stark picture there. And actually, I wasn't as worried until I read his piece, to be honest.
Yeah, well, that's it. He's a county board chairman, so I suppose he could give a bit of an insight onto that. Also in the Irish Mail on Sunday, they've been consistently the strongest on GAA. Well, they committed more to GAA pieces than any other newspaper. So he's a piece with Antrim footballer Declan Lynch, and he's a Sinn Féin advisor as well, and he's talking about an all-inclusive vision for the association in the north. And to be honest with you, I don't know half enough of that kind of subject to even start commenting on it, so I'm not going to comment on it. I was bad enough on the Mark Gallagher piece there with the club name, so I'm not going to start going down giving an opinion on unionists. I know there have been some banners, Conan, in Antrim after the new GAA club's been set up saying GAA is anti-British and they're not welcome.
Yeah, and that's a difficulty. I think that's probably the difficulty Jarlath Burns ran into one time, where he was talking about, you know, well, he was just musing about getting rid of the national anthem and, you know, stuff like the tricolour and stuff at the stand for, you know, maybe be more GAA rather than be so tied to nationalism. I don't know, it's difficult, like, you know, because that's where the GAA sprang from, but it is a different world now, and like, I would like to see way more unionists play, because it's just a class sport more than anything, you know, and it's such a great community thing. So it would just be great, like, we're we're so far down the line now. Like, we should be having more inclusivity, and we have to start that conversation.
Yeah, exactly. So Sunday World, then, just to finish up, lads, is Sean McGoldrick talks to Micheál Briody, the Club Players Association, and we've kind of covered all that stuff. We're not going to go back over it. Pat Spillane has a strange enough piece in that the first five paragraphs are about himself. So he talks about one surefire way to lose friends and gain enemies is to write a newspaper column. On occasions, I've earned the wrath of the entire province of Ulster, but nothing prepared me for the wave of reaction my recent articles on COVID-19 provoked. Last month, I suggested that the government and the GA had initially reacted brilliantly to the coronavirus pandemic. They had become overly cautious. Then he talks about what he argued. And then he says, on the other hand, the keyboard, he says, most of those who got in touch, including one government minister and a couple of other leading politicians, agreed with me. On the other hand, the keyboard warriors and some broadcasters decided to take cheap pot shots at me. What does Pat Spillane know about medical issues? Why should anybody take medical advice from Spillane? It was a lazy response, and I won't labour the point. You've just laboured the point, Pat, if I have to say. The first, like I say, first six paragraphs are about himself. And not only are they about himself, they're about an opinion he completely flip-flopped on. So first he thought John Horan was completely right. Then he flip-flopped it on in a week. Now he's crying poor me that people are complaining and giving him grief about it. Like, I mean, I didn't want to read on, Conan, after that. I actually didn't want to read on. If you're going to start an opinion piece talking about yourself, about an opinion that you've completely turned 360 on or 180 on, well, then I don't really want to read on.
Yeah. Ironically, he was talking about the GA being behind, you know, the government and stuff. But I was thinking, Pat Spillane is behind on this issue. Like, you know, this was a piece for 2 weeks ago. I'm disappointed you didn't read on, though, because he got another special quote down there at the very end, the very last paragraph.
What's that now? Let me see.
It was from it was from the Buddha.
We'll finish on the Buddha quote then. I actually did read on. I'm just saying I didn't. He actually went on to describe John Horan's Sunday Game interview as car crash. He agreed with it. He actually agreed with it. It's incredible how you can actually call something a car crash when you agreed with it after and then changed your mind on it. And now it's a car crash. Anyways, we'll finish the show on this quote. Perhaps we ought to remember the words of the Buddha, who said, I give the context of this. Certainly there are interesting days ahead with lots of twists and turns on this unique journey. Perhaps we ought to remember the words of the Buddha, who said, the secret for both mind and body is not to mourn the past, worry about the future, or anticipate troubles, but to live in the present moment wisely and earnestly. We'll talk to you on Thursday.
And when I started running, I suppose I didn't stop. And when I got the chance to go, I said I'd stay going. So it opened up.
We're only the small little fish out there, so we are. And we're trying hard to make it through. But it's hard to get the breaks when you're the smaller fish.
Because I love this county so much, you know. And it's just, I'm delighted that the lads did it for the people of Waterford today. Because, like, I'm heartbroken.